call the House Resources meeting to order. The time is 1 o'clock. In attendance, we have Representative Olson, Gatto, Co-Chair Samuels and Ramos, Vice Chair Seaton, Representative Elkins. Mr. Gatto, do you have a motion?
I move HJR 6 with individual recommendations.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, HJR 6 is moved. We'll take a brief at ease.
We got to have the record.
Take a brief at ease.
Thank you.
There you go.
We're back on record. For the record, Representative Samuels is going to just go into what we did for the benefit of of the audience.
For the audience out there, HJR 6, which just passed out of committee, had all co-sponsors. We'd already sent a letter regarding the country of origin labeling for fish. We'd sent a letter to make a federal timeline. So the resolution that we just passed out of here is catching up to the letter, which has already been sent. So thusly, the discussion was kind of a moot point. So I just wanted to clarify that, what we had just done.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right, we're going to proceed. We're going to proceed to HB 107. Try and cover that somewhat expeditiously, and then open testimony today on HB 130 without the expectation of rushing anybody or closing testimony. And we don't intend to move that bill today either, just for the benefit of the anxiety of folks that are out there. Okay, for HB 107, which is the attorney fees, the hunting, fishing interference before us, is the blank committee substitute version F, which I would entertain a motion to adopt House Resource Committee version. So we get a motion from somebody? Did you move?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I move that we adopt the CS for HB 107 resources /F version for discussion purposes.
Is there any objections?
I'd object.
Okay, for discussion.
I have A also.
I've got F.
You have F?
The F version was passed around to all the offices earlier this week.
That may be, but I have A.
Okay, I also need one.
Yeah, I have A also, John.
Take an Eddie.
We'll take a brief at ease. Back on the record, everybody should have committee substitute F in front of them. Is that correct? And for the purposes of discussion, Jim Pound, you want to proceed with the changes to CSF, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Jim Pound, staff for Representative Ramos. The changes that we made, essentially what you'll see, really we added in language that was in the section 790, which was the preceding of the original bill, primarily having to do with the way this bill was this language was originally written. It was sort of 790 was to take care of the criminal side, 791 was to take care of the civil side of obstruction, and in the discussions with the Alaska State Troopers and the court system, this is additions that they thought would help, and particularly with the court system's fiscal note, possibly bringing it down to zero. The first one on page 2, line 4 and 5, this is based on a criminal situation in which the individual actually cut a trap line and released the animals, but because of the existing statute, the only thing they could charge the individual with was criminal mischief, which is a fairly broad, usually considered to be a misdemeanor. The second change is on page 2, line 14 and 15. This is based on a recent suit that was just settled with the Department of Fish and Wildlife when a Fish and Wildlife helicopter flew over, was operating at a low altitude, checking the operations that were going on. The complainant in this case alleged that the helicopter was flying so low and all the fish jumped out of his net. And the state ended up having to pay a settlement on that one to finish that one. So this will help it with a police officer or a law enforcement officer being able to be involved without fear of being the state being sued for obstruction. And in regards to the full attorney fees that we discussed the other day, in most of the cases that we'll be looking at that's in Section 791, that's the original language of the bill, is we are normally dealing with something that has already had a criminal conviction. This is primarily language intended to further induce individuals not to obstruct people enjoying the Alaska lifestyle, similar to what the criminal side of it would be as well. And there was also a question the other day regarding intentionally obstruct. And if you'll also look in your package, you'll find part of the original language of 1605-790, where intentionally obstruct is listed in the statute text under paragraph A. For further definition on intentionally is to do something purposely and not accidentally. That's a Black's Law description, which is the standard dictionary that's used for our courts. And also, a person acts intentionally if he desires, to cause consequences of his acts or he believes the consequences are substantially certain to result, which takes care of the question of what is intentional and what is not intentional that we discussed the other day. If you have any further questions, I'd be glad to see if I can help answer them for you.
Any questions? Seeing, yes, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. You know, one of our questions the other day was dealing with fishing gear, and I noticed that we have on page 2, section 2, amended to read, the section does not apply to, and this is lawful competitive practices among persons engaged in lawful hunting, fishing, or trapping. And, of course, you know, we have distances between net regulations in the salmon gillnet fisheries. So as I read this, since that was not a lawful competitive practice, therefore that exception wouldn't be here and we would have civil liability formed and filed with full compensation of attorney's fees, because that's not an exception under here, because this only relieves or only exempts lawful competitive practices. So any portion of that practice which would be found to be non-lawful, such as two nets being too close together, would not fulfill this exemption, and then therefore commercial fishing in those situations would be included in this full award of attorney fees for the plaintiff. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I'm not an attorney. I would certainly gather that that would be the interpretation under the courts.
Follow up, Representative Seaton?
We're under discussion, or are we on? If we're under discussion, I'll go ahead and comment on that.
If you'd remove your objection to adopting the CS, I'll move the CS, and then you can.
I'm trying to remember from last week whether we closed public testimony on this. Does anybody have a recollection of that? Is there anybody here who wishes to testify on this on 107?
There you have it.
There we have it. Okay, public testimony is closed. Anybody online that wants to testify on 107? Okay, public testimony is closed on 107. Committee discussion. Go ahead, Representative Seaton.
And Mr. Chairman, following co-chair Samuel's suggestion, I'll remove my objection to the adoption of the CS, and then I'll object to the passage. I'll remove my objection.
Okay.
I move that we pass along CS for HB 107 out of resources.
And I'll object.
Okay.
For purposes of discussion.
And following that discussion, Mr. Chairman, this seems like we are going to have a potential very large unanticipated consequence of putting commercial fishermen engaged in activities of commercial fishing, if there's any portion of what they're doing being not a legal enterprise, such as nets are too close together, we would then put them in the circumstance of getting full attorney fees and full costs for the plaintiff, and the defendant, even if they win, would be limited by Rule 82 to probably a maximum of 30% of their attorney fees. So I do not think that we've solved that problem in this bill, and so I, you know, we do have a very significant question for commercial fishing in this bill, although I don't believe it's intended to be in there. That's the effect of what we have.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Representative Ledoux?
I've got the same problem with it, and I guess my problem even goes beyond the commercial fishing aspect of things, although I see that actually as the most significant problem. But just the idea that one person might accuse somebody else of doing something wrong, if the accuser is right and prevails, that person gets full attorney's fees. If the accused is totally exonerated, that person is limited to just 30, generally speaking, 30%. And that just strikes me as fundamentally unfair.
Any other discussion? Representative Seaton?
Sure. Well, following up on that, the other portion of this is not only full attorney fees, but since it takes out of Rule 82 the words reasonable attorney fees, it means that as we have under Rule 82, that they have to consider the number of lawyers, whether it was a reasonable number of lawyers, the person employed, et cetera, those would be off of the table for the judge to determine whether they were reasonable or not. So it would be any full and actual attorney fees, no matter how egregious those could be by the plaintiff in the case. And so it seems to me that we're putting in a situation, and I'll again relate it back to a commercial fishing situation, in which we may have people just loading up attorney fees to make the other person default on the case instead of having the case go to court, because the actual amount that they would have to pay under the civil charge by the plaintiff could be so egregious. And so I think we need to make some changes before we move this from committee.
Representative Gatto?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've had some experience with Rule 82. In that, I'll give you an example. You can sue for $3,000, and it gets very testy. And as a result, both sides hire attorneys, and the attorney fees start approaching $10,000, and you're trying to intimidate your opponent. If you prevail under Rule 82, but you're only awarded $3,000, the most you can get back is 20% of the $3,000, which puts a limit on you for saying, listen, I can hire any attorney, I can hire a bank of attorneys. I don't care because I will get back my attorney's fees. But the way it exists now, it's subject to a limited amount, which is a percent of the amount that you will prevail. So I'm concerned that there'll be some people who cannot or not willing to take the risk and simply will default in the judgment and pay up, because they can pay the judgment, but they could not even begin to pay the attorney's fees. So I have that concern that's been voiced by my colleagues across the table.
Any other discussion?
Just voicing what everybody else has said, I have the same concerns I had with the original draft, and I can't support this.
Okay, well, let's take it back, and we'll work on it some more and clean it up and bring it back. But we'll just keep ticking away on 107 until we get something that seems to satisfy the will of the committee. Okay, HB 130. As I stated earlier, It's not the intent of the committee to amend or move this bill today. We simply want to take some public testimony. We've got a number of people that are signed to testify. I'm going to ask that folks are considerate when it comes to redundant testimony. Initially, I'm going to bring Bob Leffler up from DNR to frame this, and then we're going to hear from Joe Beadle at the university, and then we will open it up to public testimony, both here in the room and teleconference. For the record, will you state your name, please, Bob?
My name is Bob Leffler. I'm the director of DNR's Division of Mining, Land, and Water.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I would probably take between 5 to 8 minutes to go over the problems and opportunities that this bill addresses, and then walk very briefly through the land list, if that seems to be the will of the committee. Okay?
Feel free, please.
Currently, our land-grant University of Alaska has a land grant of approximately 170,000 acres. It's one of the smallest land grants of any of our Western state land grant institutions. The idea of augmenting that land grant has been around for a number of years. It's been addressed by a number of previous legislators. It was espoused by the governor when he was senator and when he was running his campaign. The legislature last addressed this question in 2001 when they passed SB 7. That was a bill to transfer 260,000 acres to the university, and it addressed this question. Unfortunately, the bill had a selection process which turned out to be inefficient, cumbersome, and had the added disadvantage of not providing the university particularly good lands for the land grant. This bill is intended to really implement the intent of SB 7 and solve the problem. That is, it is a low-cost, efficient solution rather than a long selection process, whereas SB 7 had a 10-year fiscal note of $17 million. This has a fiscal note from DNR of less than 5% from that amount. So rather than a long, cumbersome selection process, we do is we've listed 71 parcels. This bill passes, those are transferred, and the cost to DNR, cost to the state, is only that cost to do title searches, reserve, identify valid existing rights, and do the usual work we do identifying and retaining public access easements, easements to navigable waters, things of that sort. So this bill has some advantages. It's certainly much cheaper. It finishes the problem quickly. It provides, I believe, a stable, useful portfolio to the university, and it eliminates the cloud on title that could occur from a 10-year, is this going to go to the university or is it going to stay with the state? So that's the problem and the philosophy behind the bill and behind the reason why we have 71 parcels listed to solve the problem. With the committee's permission, I would like to just take a second and explain the portfolio of lands. Dick Milius, my deputy director, will, I guess, be the VANA for this exercise, if you will. What we have is a portfolio of 260,000 acres, a third of which are educational properties that strengthen the education mission of the university. A third of them are in one single oil and gas tract, which is a prospective gas tract opposite Nanana. It's a 90,000 acre tract, so 90,000.
Pardon me, Bob. Representative Samuels?
I don't know if you want to wait until you're through, but...
Oh, no, I'm
just like some clarification on what do you mean by an educational property.
The educational properties are ones that are not designed primarily to make money. They're designed primarily to strengthen the educational mission. The best way for me to explain it is with an example. There's a 51,000-acre university research forest. That one will actually continue to be managed by DNR for 50 years. But the purpose of that, it's a working forest, like many university forests, but the purpose of that is to dedicate that, protect it for purposes of research. We think that is significant in having, it provides one of the largest research forests or university-related forests in the nation.
Is it being used for research right now?
Portions of it are. the Caribou Poker Fleet, Poker Creek watershed is an experimental watershed that is used for hydrologic research. This just solidifies that use, if you will. So they are really designed to...
Just, and it's just those two?
No, they're actually...
How many acres out of the 250?
It's one-third, so it's 90,000 acres, and it is 12 properties statewide. The largest of the properties are the 50,000-acre University Research Tract, the Caribou Poker Flats Watershed, the Poker Flat Rocket Range, and I think after that it's the Kodiak Launch Facility area.
Thank you.
Another third, another 90,000 acres, is that prospective oil and gas tract, which is opposite Nenana. That is a potential long-term income source for the university. Our Division of Oil and Gas thinks it's highly prospective for gas, and if commercial quantities are found, would be exportable to Fairbanks. Should that occur, this is a long-term income source for the University of Alaska. The last third, or 80,000 acres to be precise, are near and midterm investment properties. Those are ones that could be subdivided or otherwise turned into cash somewhat quicker. And that's half divided throughout the state and half in Southeast. Now, I would like to make two observations before I go to some of the Southeast parcels and region, is be quite frankly, DNR's holdings have been picked over. We just don't have a lot of valuable land that's good for subdividing or can be quickly turned into cash. That is between municipal entitlements, the mental health trust settlements, previous university settlements, Cook Inlet Land Exchange, and other similar things. DNR just doesn't have that kind of land near the road system, near Anchorage or Fairbanks anymore.
Thank you. Back to the oil and gas leases. Are the university's rules the same as DNR's rules? Is that statewide rules as far as leasing the property out?
Yes and no.
Your time frame or a harder time frame?
Yes and no. Right now there is a license on that by Andex Corporation. So the property right, Andex Corporation has the right to go from exploration to development should they find it. And this valid existing right transfers with the land. So should Andex find gas, they have the right to develop, and it's really under...
It's leased, and that part's already done.
Yes. Should Andex you know, leave and somebody else come in, the university could have different rules. I don't suspect, frankly, it's a lot easier or harder, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Continue, Mr. Loeffler.
Let me go to the investment lands. I mentioned that we don't have... Half of them are in Southeast, and those are really our most valuable lands. That is, many of the other value lands have been picked over. And the map that's up here shows 44 parcels throughout Southeast. And I'd like to spend a second to describe how we came up with those. We decided that we couldn't allow the university to get forestry parcels because our Division of Forestry is cuts all their allowable cut in southern Southeast. Therefore, anything given to the university would come off DNR's allowable cut, and we would be supplying less to local mills. So we took forestry off the table. We took anything DNR was actually planning on selling within the next 5 years off the table. And third is... We tried to take many of the sensitive parcels off the table. So it's impractical to go to all of the communities. So what we used as a proxy was we used our area plan process. That is, we went through our area plans and tried to look at only the development, those that were categorized in a development category, particularly settlement or general use. Of the 44 parcels in there, 37 are settlement or classified for settlement and general use. And so that's how we came up with this. The importance of the Southeast parcels, again, are they are the major near-term income source for this package. That's really my testimony. I guess I just would like to end with one observation. We would, of course, like to have been able to pick parcels that were not in everybody's, not in someone's backyard. And I remember when I came to Alaska in 1977 and started working with DNR, that was actually possible. It's sort of no longer possible. Everywhere we have is in someone's backyard. And it's an observation, I think, that this transfer makes clear.
Thank you, Mr. Leffler. First, for the record, Representative Crawford has joined us. Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you describe the process if you wanted to sell an individual parcel in Southeast or around Fairbanks or any of them? If DNR wanted to sell it, what kind of a process do you have to go through as opposed to if the university wants to sell them? Is the process the same for one agency versus another agency to try to sell them?
No. I'll let the university speak to their process. But, of course, we have a somewhat expansive public process, which I think is appropriate and we're proud of. But first we go through an area plan to classify it for settlement. Then we go through a best interest finding process with public notice, et cetera, take comments, address them, a final best interest finding. And then we sell it competitively.
And there's a state program that does this on an ongoing basis?
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, my understanding is that when the state sells lands, they're required to retain access rights along rivers and other water bodies. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And has the state maintained those right-of-ways with these transfers as well?
Yes, we have. We would reserve. On most of the maps in the book, easements are actually shown, but the law specifically says that we would identify in our title process similar easements to navigable waters along shorelines, et cetera, and retain those in DNR management.
Okay. So that process, whether it went transferred to the university or whether it transferred to an individual, was the same process and the same right-of-ways have been revived?
Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Representative Crawford?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been looking at these, and a lot of them I just don't understand what the rationale, what was the rhyme or reason as to how you chose them. I'd really like to know, what I want to do is get the most money to the university in the shortest amount of time as we possibly can. Some of these things don't look like they're going to be marketable. If you could get me a list of how you arrived at some of these.
I'm happy to tell you.
Like the Bjorka Island property there, what I hear is it's a sea lion pullout. I don't know what you could do to develop that and turn that into cash for the university. Or maybe it's an area to study. Sure. I don't know. Those are the kind of questions that I would like to have answered before we move this bill on, is so that I had a better idea of what we're actually doing here.
I can't address Bjorka Island in particular. Except in general, we would go through a land use process, we work closely with the public and the resource agencies. And of those, these were most of the parcels in Southeast that were classified for settlement or general use. So after our land use process, DNR decided they were appropriate for a variety of uses or appropriate to sell. And that was the inventory we looked at first. Mm-hmm. The Bjorka Island process, the Bjorka Island parcel in particular, the land use plan said, I'm reading, was considered appropriate for settlement, particularly remote cabin sites. So that was the determination after that land use process. I'm not sure what else to say. And that's in the back of the book.
Another thing that was brought up yesterday when your staff was visiting me, they said that we were putting a small portion of the state land up at Willow, making that available to the university. That's near a large population center, it seems to me like we, I mean, that's where we really should be concentrating, trying to put as much state land into private hands as we possibly could. I mean, that's where there seems to be a real need.
Mr. Chairman, oh, I'm sorry, I should interrupt.
Go ahead.
I agree, and if we had land, we would put it there. But that land has either gone to the borough in their 350,000-acre municipal entitlement, has gone to the Mental Health Trust, has gone in a previous university court settlement, or the Cook Inlet Land Exchange. So the state doesn't own land near roads in that area.
No. Okay. I thought what was said was that there was still many thousands of acres of the Willow area.
Oh, gentlemen, I appreciate the open, free-flowing dialogue, but if you go through the chair, I'd appreciate it just so we maintain a certain amount of decorum in the room.
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman.
No problem.
My apologies, Mr. Chairman.
Like you both. Go ahead. Feel free. Who's next?
The Capitol site does have 60,000 acres. A lot of it is not suitable for settlement or is slightly remote from the road. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Crawford? Representative Ledoux.
I'm trying to figure out what use the university can make of the rocket launch range in Kodiak.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's probably appropriate for the university. I will say that as the Kodiak Mirror indicated earlier today or yesterday, that it probably dovetails with our ownership of Poket Flats Rocket Range near the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I think in the long term, it may be appropriate for use of that for the same kinds of research that they use for Poker Flats. But I think that's an appropriate question for Mr. Beadle.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Loeffler? Representative Elkins?
You know, I'm confused about many of these parcels of land, but one in particular closest to my heart is the Neach Bay property. You know, that that's the watershed for the Sarah Hatchery down there, and that hatchery generates in the neighborhood of $28 million in goods and services annually to Ketchikan local economy. I just don't know why you'd want to surplus that watershed out and jeopardize an operation that's the most successful fish hatchery in the whole state, but definitely in southeastern, produces a great number of fish, and I can tell you in our area we're upset about it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, certainly we don't. I wouldn't want to jeopardize the Neach Bay hatchery. They have a lease with the state. It isn't quite perfected yet, but they have the property right. That property right goes from now till 2030. So the hatchery area itself is a valid existing right that the property right exists no matter who we transfer to. The question of the surrounding area and the habitat that maintains that hatchery is also important, for without that habitat, the hatchery is not a hatchery. But my expectation is that the university is the kind of manager that you would want as a landlord, and that in fact they understand the importance of that. But again, that's a question for Mr. Beadle, but we certainly never thought that having the university as a landlord to that habitat would jeopardize the hatchery.
Well, there certainly is a constituency, I've read their emails, that are concerned about precisely that, but that is more appropriate for Mr. Beadle to discuss. Do you have a follow-up, Representative Elkins?
Yeah, I don't know what the lease says about the watershed, but I agree with you. They do have a lease for the footprint of the hatchery itself.
Right.
But I'm not sure if there any way are protect the watershed's protected.
Well, the lease doesn't address the watershed. The state's land use plan says that the watershed includes both previous harvested and some areas that are appropriate for commercial harvest. So that would have been DNR's plan for the area, but of course we would have coordinated that with the Neach Bay Hatchery. And you should ask Mr. Beadle. I doubt that they will do different.
Any other questions for Mr. Loeffler? We certainly will have access to him as testimony continues. So I might encourage us as a committee to proceed with Mr. Beadle's presentation and then start to fill in with individual testimony, and then when the committee feels it'd be valuable to bring Mr. Leffler back up to do some follow-up from State DNR, we certainly will have access, I think, to bringing you back and forth, Bob, if you're amenable to that. Is that
I'm at your convenience, Mr. Chairman. Right, thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Hi, Joe. For the record, would you state your name and position with the university, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Resource Committee. My name is Joe Beadle. I'm Vice President for Finance, the Chief Financial Officer for the university. Today, I sit before you as a trustee, as the treasurer trustee for the Land Grant Endowment Fund for the university. And it is that very trust that takes the receipts from land sold by the university and in perpetuity holds, invests, and then provides to the university a percentage of the earnings, a portion of the earnings, for the Board of Regents and the President's discretion. It's a very important aspect of land-grant universities throughout the country. I think you already know the background of the University of Alaska. We're a land-grant university, in essence, without the land. Many states in the Union received more than 1 million acres of land. We have received the smallest amount of land of any state as a land-grant university other than Delaware and Hawaii. So it's a dubious distinction to be that far down on the list. Philosophically, when the Morrell Act passed in the 1860s, the concept of land-grant universities was to encourage engagement by having ownership of land with the community, and also to provide for a funding source for universities, for institutions of public higher education. SB 7 has passed. It is withheld a challenge before the state Supreme Court and found to be law, SLA Chapter 136. The DNR challenge, kind of in transitioning to what the university would be doing with the land, was not an insignificant challenge to find land that would benefit the university under the philosophy of the Morrell Act and the land-grant universities in general, to provide income-producing or economically viable land for the university in a meaningful way. Their first priority needed to be to do it consistent with their area plans. And we're all familiar with boroughs and cities that have planning and zoning powers, but what happens in areas that do not have organized boroughs to establish use of properties. So DNR does these area plans. We have been visiting since Monday Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg. Today, tomorrow, we'll be here in Juneau, and then we'll be in Sitka with just informational meetings. And we are getting a lot of feedback, and most people are not aware of those area plans, even though that was an extensive effort by the state. So the state has these area plans. They had to retain philosophically and as a priority a state forest for timber harvesting. They needed to retain 5 years of their own supply of land sales. They needed to preserve the habitat that Fish and Game and the Habitat Division identified as important for our ecosystems, flora and fauna. And so investigating these area plans, there's already, emphasis added, already designated parcels for settlement, for development, for recreation. And when I say that, recreation does not mean casual or public. It in many cases means recreational cabins. It in some cases means tourism. And the university's had significant experience. I'll give you some of statistics for the kind of sales we've had. We do not have specific plans yet developed. This is an opportunity to identify lands that then our professionals, and working with professionals in your communities, with your municipalities, with the local interest groups, to identify what the opportunities are in those areas. The University of Alaska, through its Board of Regents, through its president, and through influence of the public, We have a process in our land management department. They are required to do a strategic plan that is over decades looking into the future what we would do with land that we already have. Part of that strategic plan hopes to have this new allocation of land provided to the university. We do annual development plans. There's a large tract of property out there that the university owns. How might we develop it? And how do we engage in a community or neighbors to identify what a compatible and economic use of the property would be? We have annual sales plans, and they're on our website at ualand.com. You can see the process, the very deliberative process that we go through. That requires a lot of public notice. And then it has board oversight, Board of Regents public oversight when a large development project or individual land sale occurs, it goes to the board for final approval. And in that process, there's ample opportunities for people to engage. So where are we with our land grant trust, the fund? We have grown over the years to approximately $130 million in an endowment and a trust fund that is specifically by your statute, by the legislative statute, required to be held in perpetuity. We currently do a best practice POMV payout, like more than 600 college and university endowments. We pay out 5% of a five-year average of the fund balance annually to the university. And then the university, through your appropriation process, through the Board of Regents deliberations, through the president and the chancellors, decide how to use those generally unrestricted or university receipt dollars that flow through the budgeting process. So that currently is grown to about $5 million a year that comes to the university, approximately 1% of our budget. The question gets asked, what could this land bill mean to the university? And as already testified by DNR, we are very hopeful and somewhat optimistic for this Nenana Basin oil and gas. But it is very speculative, and there's no way of knowing. We currently hope in a 20-year period, so selling property, receiving what the states share, the 1/8 royalty of the gas, that all of that combined going into the land grant trust fund could amount to as much as $50 million over the next 20 years. And we believe generate in the range of $2 to $3 million a year after 20 years, recalling it goes into the fund and only the earnings off of it are distributed to the university. So a little bit on our statistics. We have sold since 1987 1,146 parcels of property. I was just in Mary Montgomery's office the other day. She's the director of land management for the university. She's in the back of the room. And a clerk processor closer had 60 files ready for closing this month out of the land management office. So we're an active office. We've sold those parcels, 1,146, equal 15,000 acres. And they have brought in approximately $44 million at principal to the university. And then, of course, we earn by investing that, and it's significantly inflation-proofed. In addition, our timber resource roughly equals this same $40 million. So our timber sales almost parallel that amount. And then the interest earnings minus what we pay out has grown us to the approximate $130 million. So this is very serious business for the university. It is not a large part of our budget, but it is that discretionary receipt authority that's so valuable for us. So we are looking forward to this opportunity. We applaud the administration, DNR's work. We look forward to the passage of this legislation and the transfer of the land so our professionals can get on with the research and marketing of the land. I'd be happy to talk about the research side and specific parcels that you might have questions on.
Thank you, Mr. Beadle. What are the total endowments that the university has? So this $130 million presently, what percentage of the total endowment to the university does it represent?
You know? An excellent question. We have a foundation. Now, it is separate from the university. It is a legally separate 501c3. It's called the University of Alaska Foundation, and it has approximately $125 million in its fund. And so together, about $250 million as permanent endowed funds under management. And then separately, funds that are not endowed, that are given to the university for scholarships to be paid out annually, or donations for a specific building fund, the museum or the ANSEP building or other buildings, they come to the university, we hold them and invest them until such time that they're drawn upon to pay that scholarship or build that building. And there would probably be another $50 million there. So we're looking at about $300 million under management. We take this time to applaud the Department of, Revenue, the Department of Revenue, and the Permanent Fund folks that help us invest some of these funds. We use Best Practice, the Callan Financial Advisor, et cetera. And so we do this through a consolidated fund investment pool, and there's a separate committee at the foundation that does that.
So it's fair to say that the university is trying to fulfill its mission as a true land-grant college, and the 50-year plan or the 100-year plan of the university is to build this endowment up, same as 100-year-old, 200, 300-year-old universities across the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may, our percentage of revenue that comes in the 1% range for the University of Alaska compares with other institutions, especially as you name those that are the older, more private ones, really average in the 10 to 25% range of returns on endowment. So we've heard over the years from the legislature, from the public, that you know, can we earn more of our own? And we can do so through such means as a land bill. So we're very small and relatively new at the game of endowment building.
Our esteemed speaker is off at Speaker of the House School at Harvard this week. Do you happen to know what kind of an endowment base does Harvard have? I assume that it's
It's approximately $28 billion, and their returns their management team is internal, and you might have heard that some of their managers get paid in the millions of dollars. $20 million was paid out internally to their fund managers. Their returns have averaged in a 15% compounded return way, and they invest considerable amounts in hedge funds, in new private equities, and they have a tremendous pipeline of information from which to invest before you and I hear about such things. It of course funds most of the school's activities. It is more than 50% of that private institution's revenue.
But we're going to enjoy a lot of testimony from committee members and from other folks, and we appreciate you staying with us. But I just want to reiterate that this is the big plan, if you will, is to try to fulfill some of the promise and the directive that we've had from President Hamilton, which is to make the University of Alaska a truly competitive institution, you know, across the country and globally, by developing resources like this endowment and by fulfilling the land grant promise and getting land into the hands of private individuals, and at the same time enriching the university to get us on the right track over the next decades, truly the 21st century. Is that a pretty accurate assessment of kind of what our primary mission is here today, Mr. Beadle?
We'd like to put you on staff as our relations in addition to Mr. Kelly. Thank you, Mr.
We'll see how things go by 3 o'clock. Anyway, are there questions for Mr. Beadle, Representative Ledoux?
Yes, I'm just trying to figure out what the university wants with the rocket launch complex out of Kodiak.
Thank you. An excellent question. And in fact, that was one of those that was suggested by some university people many years ago. So unlike some that are a surprise to us, this one is not a surprise that it's on this list. The University of Alaska, unlike many public universities, does not have a medical school or a research medical school or a law school. And yet, what are we known for? We're known for our Geophysical Institute. And by federal legislation dating back to the 1940s, Congress recognized this study of northern latitudes and the advantage to be in a circumpolar enterprise. Satellites that circle in the northern latitudes can be interrogated, you know, like 12 times the number of times something around the equator. The study of the aurora, the study of global change. So even back in the 1940s, that was recognized. The establishment of the Geophysical Institute is roughly equal to what another institution's medical research school would be. So it is our institute of international prominence. And so their studies include from the center of the sun to the center of the earth. They have done considerable studies of the atmosphere. They are studying the global change, as you know. They do have a SAR facility, a satellite aperture resonance facility, huge contracts with NASA. We have investments from Japan, and their equivalent agency is NASA. They have invested $20 million on the Fairbanks campus to coordinate with the Geophysical Institute. And we have built a rocket range, the University of Alaska, with Department of Defense, with NASA, and with similar agencies at Poker Flat and near Caribou Creek that was mentioned on the map. And so it is a area of excellence that the University of Alaska takes pride in and wants to expand. So if there's going to be other opportunities in the state, whether they be research, whether they be for rocket or satellite launches, the University of Alaska wants to be in the game. And sometimes it gives us an advantage to be in the game to have real estate. If we don't have money immediately available to match fund to compete, the land around the launch site will give us a place at the table. And whether that means that it is for research, which our scientists really want to be involved with, whether it's ocean observing systems that also help the resources in the area through satellite interrogation, or whether it's a long-term investment, if it should be a Kennedy Space Center someday. We really want to be on the ground floor with our scientists, with our energy, with our resources. And this is probably one of the only ways, in addition to our science, that we can be. And we do have a seat on that board. As you know, President Hamilton is on that board. We look forward to spending some time sharing with you what we do at Poker Flat. There's a park near Poker Flat. There's a wild and scenic river. There's fishing. There's an old dredge. And we frankly, from the Chattanooga Lodge adjacent to the property, get high marks for how we deal with that local community when rockets are launched. And we preclude them from being three-day weekends and during times when that community values that space. I believe we'd be an excellent land partner that Kodiak would be pleased to work with. And I think our public process would be one that would reward a community interaction.
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
I guess I was just wondering about two things. First of all, since the president of the university is also, is he the president of the rocket launch?
He's on the board. He chairs the board. Through the chair.
Don't you already have a place at the table? And then my second question was, through the chair, through a lease or some sort of arrangement with the rocket launch folks, couldn't you guarantee yourself a place at the table? Do you really need to own the land for that?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the University of Alaska does not need to own land to do research. You bring up an interesting point, and I would add that Mary Montgomery's leadership in the land management area currently manages for the university the permitting process, the permission to do research on public. That would be federal and state land, more than 1 million acres. So I think you bring up an interesting point for everyone. We do not need to own land to do research on it. We do a lot of research on land that is owned by private, state, and federal agencies. Okay, now as to what the process is and what we can do with land, as you know and as individuals know, there are restrictions. And when we can write those rules for those restrictions and be at the table, we really have a stronger seat at that table when we combine a board seat with a land or an investment opportunity and the science that we enjoy.
Thank you.
For the record, Representative Samuels had leave to go bring a bill up in front of the Finance Committee. Representative Gatto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Recently, I guess last year, the university had some extremely valuable real estate next to the new hospital in Palmer. I think it was only 9 acres, but it went for an incredible amount of money. Did that money go for the day-to-day operations of the university, or does that money go into an endowment, or does that money go into just the budget?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, there are restrictions on federal grant lands that the university gets, and the federal grant land that we received, approximately 113,000 acres that was supposed to be more than a third of a million, does have restrictions that it go into the land grant trust. Any transfer of land with this bill mandates in statute that it would go into the land grant trust. There has been other processes by which the university has gained land. In the specific case of the Palmer Research Farm area, land was provided to the university when it was abandoned by that colonization of the Mat-Su Valley by the federal government and provided to the university without restriction. So I'm answering your questions two ways. Absolutely every penny of that money has gone into the land grant trust fund. But that's the University of Alaska Board of Trustees that required that. There could be other uses for that property or proceeds. There was not. There is not anticipated to be. They've not given us any encouragement to do so. The sale of property that went, we first declined when that request was made for Triad to buy property from us. They bought adjoining private property. And then they found themselves in a position to need adjacent space for parking. They came to the university. We went through a public process to allow them to purchase property. And it is very true that what was being sold initially for $1.40 a square foot grew to in the range of $6 a square foot virtually overnight because of their identification of that purchase. The University of Alaska has received or will receive by the time of closing some $5 million for a very small piece of property. And that is indicative of what land management does. Highest, best use, highest value, willing buyer, willing seller. So we're actually quite pleased. One more note on the property. The land grant trust fund also will buy property when there's an opportunity. Adjacent to the Palmer Farm was a private sale, Breeden by name, and you know that property, Representative Gatto. The university purchased 40 acres approximately 12 years ago, and we purchased that for less than 50 cents per square foot. So that investment will someday return something to the land grant trust. And what I wanted to communicate is, contrary to what some public opinion is, we've actually provided more property to that approximately 1,900 acres between Mat-Su campus and the farm. We've actually added more than we've subtracted by sales. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Additional questions for Mr. Beadle? Yes, Representative Olson.
Mr. Beadle, has anybody expressed interest in the land up at around Nanana, the oil and gas land? Since this become common knowledge that that may be transferred to you?
An excellent question. So DNR, in their normal process of looking for opportunities, have had this on their agenda for a long time, and they placed the opening for exploration permit, and Andex secured that permit. That is over 400,000 acres permitted to Andex. And Doyon Regional Corporation towards Minto also owns the surface and subsurface. And so Doyon has also been doing exploration. And what has now occurred with Andex, based on a permit from DNR, that we will inherit with significant potential value, all of their work. So the land ownership includes Mental Health Trust, Doyon, some of the surface estate of the village corporations in the area, and the University of Alaska. So our acreage of that 400-plus thousand that has been leased to Andex for exploration is about 90,000 acres. It looks very promising based on what DNR has very openly shared with the university. Now, investors recently have coughed up dollars and participated with Andex. Andex has sought investors. They include Usability Energy, cash investment to do the development, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and Doyon. The university has even asked that group if we might be able to invest some of the land-grant trust inflation-proofing dollars, and they've indicated they've raised all their money, thank you very much, and that they don't need too much more. But it does show the excitement that DNR first expressed to us, and we'll be honest with you, we didn't necessarily believe it at first. And there needs to be a lot more. This 3D seismic will be done by March. They will hopefully drill in the future. So it is pretty exciting. We do own some property, land-grant trust, on the peninsula near Anchor Point, and we're hopeful someday to have some gas royalties from that property as well.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the event that the state were to transfer some property to the university and then some years later have a need to have it back, is there some arrangement that says whatever you get it, if you gave it to us for free, you get it for free, or does it go for fair market value? Is there some arrangement that takes care of that?
Some of the questions that have come up earlier, as the university owns land, we've traded land as well with the state. I would expect as a quasi-state agency that we would want to work with DNR and try to do a mutually acceptable exchange of land, as well as with boroughs such as that exist. So we actually are pretty flexible in our ability to solve these kinds of issues. But we would be looking for, as a trust, we'd be looking for fair value when we negotiated that kind of an opportunity.
Thank you. Representative Elkins?
Do you have a question? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe, I heard you tell President Ledoux why you selected the Kodiak land. I'm wondering why you selected Neats Bay. I know you were there in the beginning when this was in infancy were actively part in helping getting it off the ground, and it kind of surprises me that it's been selected.
Through the chair, unlike Kodiak, we were not a part of the expression of desire to select very many parcels in Southeast Alaska. I might have my name on one that we could talk about privately, but so the Neats Creek, Neats Bay, Beam Canal property, which my banking career days back in Don Amon's time at SARA, Southern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, I'm very familiar and having personally benefited from that harvest area. So it was a surprise to us. Having said that, I believe that we could work with SARA if we became the owner. We appreciate that there's valid existing rights to preserve SARA's right, especially in that cost recovery harvest area and whatnot. We believe those uplands, which are considerable, have value. For the rest of the committee's benefit, that area had been extensively logged. It was logged in a clear-cut fashion prior to the use, so it's a second growth area. It would be wrong and not compatible to ever again with that current use to clear-cut log it. If the university owns it in perpetuity, there will be some opportunities in second growth. It would certainly not be through a conventional cut. It would have to be through a selective cut helicopter extraction sort of scenario. I believe there's recreational opportunity and or tourism opportunity for the rest of the committee. The attraction of those bears to those fish and the sightseeing that occurs with Promac and the Hack family and Yes Bay and all the others that use it, I believe the very fact that those fish return there are an asset that has value to other people, just as Katmai does for bear viewing. and the lodges that exist around the area, still preserving that natural habitat. Having said that, we understand fully, having met with Sarah three different times on Monday while we were in Ketchikan, what their concerns would be. We're sensitive to their issues.
Yeah, Joe, could you speak to an issue for me, please? Because I suspect as we take more and more public testimony, we're going to run into this, which is that Representative Ledoux has probably got not very much concern about the Borealis forest in Nenana, you know, and probably thinks that that's okay property for the state to take. And no disrespect meant, Representative Ledoux. And I think that what we're going to hear a lot of, because I'm anxious to open this up to public testimony, is that we're going to hear a lot of, why are you taking this 20 acres? Why are you taking this 200 acres? And in every case, it's going to be valid. And Mr. Leffler spoke to that a little bit, and I wonder if you would just, again, talk about the university's approach to this, because ultimately, we're all going to feel fine about 250,000 of this 260,000 acres, and then we're going to spend the next several hours debating the merits of the last 10,000 acres that's that's out there for acquisition. Can you just address the university's point of view on that for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excellent question. Land has as much emotion as family does. Land is forever, and the ownership of land is precious. We aren't building any more of that. So we recognize through these 1,100 transactions that there's emotions associated with real estate. And our board and our president and our chancellors are very concerned about the reputation that the university has and wants to maintain and wants to enhance. So it's an awkward thing for Mary Montgomery and Land Management to sell the land, to provide it to the investment side. And we walk a delicate line, how to preserve a good reputation for the university and have the population of Alaska want to send their students for school at the university. So our sensitivity is pretty high. The Board of Regents, upon knowing that something was to happen, asked in advance of their February 17th meeting next week that we be sure to tour Southeast as a starting point ASAP. So the bill's announced on Friday by the governor in the afternoon, and three of us, DNR lent one of their people to join us, a senior property planner, to join us. And so we will be doing this. We do have a very significant process. We will probably not be addressing property that's provided to us that is going to immediately cause a lot of problems. We'll probably wait until the timing is right, until we can build credibility with the local community. Having said that, it is about economic gain for the trust. So the university's process from the Board of Regents through the staff is such that I believe when people are finished observing what we've done, and I would add, a student last year did their thesis on customer satisfaction with University of Alaska land grant process, and the customer satisfaction survey was into the 90 percentile. I'd be happy to provide this to you, and it was done scientifically with faculty that weren't necessarily supportive of land transfers by the university. So this student independently did this study. I hope they got an A for it. I don't know that. And it showed just an outstanding degree of confidence and pleasure with working with the university through these land purchases.
I suspect that would be a useful document. I think we'd probably appreciate that. Representative Ledoux?
Through the chair. Well, I was just wondering when you were, I think, saying that you appreciate community concerns and probably wouldn't touch the more sensitive areas immediately. Would you in the university be amenable to just taking off the table some of those sensitive areas in order to allow this bill to go forward without consideration of those areas?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, the bill calls for approximately 260,000 acres. Fully one-third of the acres are for research, not anticipated to be income property. The other one-third is speculative. If it has gas on it, it will be a wonderful benefit to the university. If it does not, it has very little, if any, residual value. So we get down to two-thirds of the property. The remaining one-third of the property, income property, frankly, is our bread and butter. I mean, it is the incremental process that allows us, through distributive throughout the state, to have programs throughout the state going simultaneously. Some work, some wane another year or two. So it is a, it will be hard to diminish. We, as structured, there is not an overselection. There is not a backup list. There is a single list. And so we, the university, would be concerned with a dilution of the bill, but would be interested in how it progresses through the process. Thank you.
Representative Elkins.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just want to say, Joe, you know, you're good. There's no doubt about it. I love you as much today as I did when you were my banker. I just want you to know that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Beadle. We're gonna proceed to public testimony. Thank you again, Mr. Beadle and Mr. Leffler, for an excellent framing of the parameters of this issue. In fairness, we're gonna work off the folks that are here in the room, and then at the same time go to the telephone. I think we'll begin here with Nancy Galstead. Nancy, are you here?
I'm here. I wasn't going to testify.
You're not going to testify? Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Rainey? State your name for the record, please, Mr. Rainey. Yeah, thank you. Mr. Rainey, we're going to try to hold comments to about 3 minutes each for folks here in the room and over the phone, and if you're so inclined, then just re-sign up, and we'll be glad to hear you for another 3 minutes.
Okay, thank you. I'm Cecil Rainey. I'm with the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly, and Mr. Chair and members of the committee, first I'd like to say that I didn't fly down here because I heard of this. We're down here to put on a seafood reception tonight, which you're all invited to, if I can plug that. I'd like to address.
Mr. Rainey, it's not going to be meatballs or chicken sticks. This is going to be high-end king crab. We were informed of that on the floor. But thank you very much, Mr. Rainey. Please continue.
I have some concerns with this bill, particularly, of course, in regard to the 2,280 acres on Kodiak Island that are containing the launch facility. It's been quite controversial. This is Monday's paper. I don't know what's happened later in the week, but, I mean, it made five-column headline across the top. I mean, it's an issue there, and there's been a lot of controversy concerning the closures there. And this area is an important recreation area for Kodiak citizens, and their access to the area has been a hot issue of late. The community in general has been very supportive of the launch facility, and it's certainly supportive of the university. We have a campus there. The borough contributes money to the university on a regular basis, and we have a really good working relationship with the university. But this bill appeared rather suddenly, and so it's a little awkward with this cloud of suspicion that surrounds everything that AADC does out there. And so we have some questions. Representative Ledoux brought up the idea of why they want this land. I've heard the explanation, and it's something we'd have to, I think we should all take a really close look at, the educational value of that land. And we also have some concerns with particularly Section 6, of the bill removes some of the language. I don't know the particulars. I don't want to get into the particulars of it, but it changes some of the public process. That what we're really concerned about is what would happen if the university decided to dispose of the land. Do all these access rights, and do they continue on? Like I say, I'm not sure the particulars, but these are things that sort of raised a red flag.
Thank you, Mr. Rainey. If you could kind of wrap up your testimony, we'd appreciate it.
Okay, the borough, basically I'd say that the borough assembly has not had time to really consider this, and all we're asking is that you give us a little more time. I understand tomorrow night Mr. Hamilton and Mr. Ladner will be in Kodiak and explain it more fully to us, and then at that time maybe we'll have more intelligent sort of...
Yes, sir. I assure you we're in no rush to pass this out of committee. That's not our intention. So we thank you very much for your testimony. I'm sorry. Representative Seaton, go ahead.
Yes, just one question. With the reservation by DNR of the entire coastline and the 2477 access road, does that take care of most of your problems, or can you identify another specific area of concern?
Well, the whole area is recreation area. People are used to driving their four-wheelers and riding their horses, and so all the land has been considered, except right with the footprint of the launch facility.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rainey. I'd like to take this opportunity to remind the committee that this is not a university bill. The university is the beneficiary, but this is the governor's bill. It was introduced by the governor, and this is a relationship between Department of Natural Resources and the University of Alaska, you know, that has done their land selections as was promised to them in the Statehood Act. So the governor's not involved. It's just kind of, you know, something that we've all got to come to terms with in a manner of speaking, as we go through this process. I next want to go over the telephone. Do we have Anissa Berry in Point Alexander? She's still with us? Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Anissa. Would you state your name for the record? And we're going to give you about 3 minutes or so. We appreciate your patience today. Thank you for testifying.
Yes, I appreciate the ability to testify. My name is Anissa Berry Frick, and I am from Port Alexander. And good afternoon to the members of the Resource Committee. We all know that Alaska is the best place to live, but the university land bill as written does no favors to the university by giving it certain parcels of state land. I really support our university and hope it to be well endowed, but I am opposed to the loss of undeveloped state lands nearby the Port Alexander and Conclusion area in southeast Alaska. I'm not sure if you have that map in your packet or not.
We do. We're looking at a map of those areas right there.
Okay. Well, this bill extremely affects the town of Port Alexander, or we call it PA. The town would be more than doubled in size with these university lands. Please consider that this bill's action violates our city's comprehensive plan by allowing changes that aren't in accord with our town's desire. It's also important to note that recent comments that were made to the DNR's Northern Southeast Area Plan recommend that no home sites be selected from the surrounding PA area. Local infrastructure that we have lacks inadequate facilities for expansion of this magnitude. We're barely able to keep up with the changes required due to federal regulation to our small water utility, and our state dock is in ill repair and at maximum capacity during our fishing season in the summer. While this may be a low-cost efficient solution for the state, as we heard earlier, I totally disagree that these particular lands are a good investment for the university. There's already a lot of private property for sale in the Port Alexander area that has been on the market for years. And if the university does plan to lot out and subdivide these parcels, it would further dilute and undermine the local market. Lastly, I'll note that these lands are really near and dear to us. we hunt and recreate regularly in these areas, and I think that this bill infringes on the Alaskan rural lifestyle. And I just ask that you all find a way to adequately fund our wonderful university in the most realistic way, to consider the needs of those living in our rural communities, and remove from the parcels, if you can't, from the bill, these parcels of land that do conflict with our local residential desires. And I really appreciate the opportunity to testify.
It's our pleasure. Ms. Berry, any questions for Ms. Berry? Thank you very much for testifying with us. We appreciate it. I'd like to come back to the room, please. Is Ron Crenshaw here, please? No? Okay, excellent. We're going to go to Lanny Brennan, I believe, in Anchorage.
Hello. Yes, I actually have a testimony reflecting the views of myself and my husband, and then a Baranoff property owner has also asked me to read her testimony, if I could be allowed to do so.
Yes, if you would state your name for the record, and you're welcome to testify. We'd like you to limit it to 3 minutes, please.
Okay, my name is Lonnie Brennan. My husband's name is Jim Brennan. This bill represents a short trip to the public process surrounding specific state land disposals. This process has been a hallmark of prior state disposals, a process which is required by Article 8, Section 10 of the Alaska Constitution, which states, no disposals or leases of state lands or interests therein shall be made without prior public notice and other safeguards of the public interest as may be prescribed by law. A saving of expense by deleting the public process embodied in the prior university lands bill, Senate Bill 7, is not sufficient justification to cut out the Alaskan public from subjecting specific disposals to the scrutiny of public hearings, nor to shortcut the time for this process to work. This is not Russia. The better specific parcel disposal decisions are those which survive meaningful public process and real scrutiny. The frustrated bums rush don't bother us with the facts approach now sought by the administration is unbecoming of Alaska and of a legislative branch which has a representative duty to look out for affected Alaskans. I specifically protest the designation of SP 1002, 267 acres of valuable public recreation lands in Warm Springs Bay on the east side of Baranoff Island. This bay, featuring a state float, has become a mecca for visiting Alaskans and others who treasure its phenomenal recreation values. Development is appropriately confined mainly to a town site which pre-existed statehood and on which many small developed and still undeveloped lots exist. The proposed disposal would surround a habitat-sensitive salt lagoon and extend up the Baranoff Lake, a trail-accessible recreation area known for its spectacular scenery and trout fishing. The area to be disposed is largely wetlands. The DNR people managing this proposed disposal appear unaware of the fact that no other public disposals have been sought or granted in this bay. Disposal of this specific parcel would be a lousy decision for the state, illustrating the weakness of a fast-track approach to a large land disposal program that also determines the specific parcels to be conveyed. I am sure that you recognize that there is no way the legislative committee process can adequately scrutinize each specific proposal. Some very knowledgeable voices whose views would be valuable to a sound disposal process will not be heard from in time. What is the big rush? Please follow the constitutional approach and meaningfully include us Alaskans in the process for state land disposal. I urge you to vote against House Bill 130, and at a minimum to exclude parcel ST 1002 from this land transfer. And then I also, if I may, read testimony from Melinda Hofstad. She's on a plane to Seattle, and she couldn't be present to read it.
Ms. Brennan, you have about a minute left if you'd like to, but I want to encourage you to present your written testimony to the LIO, and they can fax it to us so we all can have a copy. If you want to take a minute, you certainly may, to offer your own testimony or to read a written statement.
It's a three-minute statement, so I will just have it sent to you.
Okay. We thank you very much for your testimony, and thank you for participating. The LIO will fax that to us here. Just provide it to them, please.
All right.
All right. Thank you again. We appreciate your sentiments. If we could go to Julie Kavanaugh in Kodiak now, please.
Julie. Yes, good afternoon.
Hi, Julie. State your name for the record, please. Oops.
Yes, sorry. My name is Julie Kavanaugh. I'm a lifetime Alaskan, and I've lived in Kodiak for 22 years. I am a supporter of the University of Alaska. I have a son who graduated in 2003 at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. I am, though, against the acquisition of the Kodiak lands parcel. I have major concerns about the fact that this parcel was put into this bill, and it sounds like from earlier testimony that this has been talked about it, but it's the first that anybody in Kodiak that I know of has heard of it. I would like to see if this bill goes through the way it is, I'd like to see the roads and trails not included in that acquisition. There are trails coming from Chiniac and Narrow Cape that are used on a year-round basis by all kinds of users. I specifically have an interest in horseback riding. We own a stables, and we take our horses out there in horse trailers all the time and use that area. It's a controversial subject in Kodiak, and it's been talked about earlier about the sensitivity of it that we have to the closures due to the rocket launch facility. And Representative Ledoux addressed that slightly when she said that maybe it would be of interest to the university to take off such a sensitive area or parcel, because I think you will hear a lot more public comment on that. I think that instead of the acquisition that you do look at a lease, because I heard that this property, from testimony of Mr. Beadle, this property is not necessarily a monetary gain, but maybe a domestic and international status thing, and that a lease would be more appropriate versus an acquisition thing. And if I misunderstand that, I would sure like to hear testimony as to what the economic gain would be other than status. I would like to say that if it can't be a lease, then you really truly do need to not include in the acquisition the roads and trails, and make sure that access to the area is guaranteed, not through management by the new owners, but in perpetuity due to the fact that they weren't included. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Kavanaugh, for your testimony. Mary Montgomery, are you still in the room? Mary, I know you're bashful, but would you mind coming up here and just sharing with the committee while we have access to your experience just how land sales work? Because there's a lot of sensitivity to how quick, how much, what's going to happen to access to trails, roads. Some of the emails I've read, it's hunting ground. Some of the questions around the hatchery or habitat. Can you just address just overall what land sales does, and then the sensitivity by way you go about disposing of this property, please? Okay.
Well, it kind of depends on the property. If we're going to develop, pardon me?
State your name for us, please.
Oh, sorry, Mary Montgomery. Thanks. Director of the university's land management office.
Thank you.
So if it's a property that we're going to subdivide or develop, we list it in our annual development plan. And we circulate that. We advertise it for 60 days, and we do direct mailings to all the legislators and all of the municipalities. Then, after it has gone through that process, we go to the Board of Regents with it and share the comments that we received with the Board of Regents. And the Board of Regents then either approve the parcels for development or don't approve them. If they're approved for development, then the next step is to determine if the properties are feasible. And in order to do that, we hire a third-party consultant typically. We go to the community closest to the development. We have typically a minimum of a one-day workshop, 8-hour workshop. Sometimes it's 12 hours. We go from 8 a.m. to 8 or 8 p.m. sometimes and hear what the community would like to see us do with the property. We listen to whether or not an example would be maybe McCarthy, which is in the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. In Anchorage, you might think two-acre lots are big lots in McCarthy. But when you go to McCarthy and talk to the people, they say, oh, no, it's got to be at least 10 or 15 acres. We have dogs that we do dog sledding. You know, we need more space. The Beaver Lake is important to us. We need green space around that. We need trails to that. So listening to that, we go back and design the project and try to take the community's concerns into consideration. Then we also put covenants and restrictions on our lots to, you know, try to have them developed in a way that's compatible with the community's desires. Then we survey it, plat it. Often have to go through a community public process. If it's an organized borough with platting authority, then we go through that process and get platting approval. Once those lots are subdivided, then we offer them for sale in a competitive annual sale and set a minimum price, offer them, and the sale is awarded to the highest bidder. We offer our own financing. So now, in the case of, say, Triad Hospital in the Mat-Su Borough, that wasn't a property we subdivided. That parcel, if we aren't going through a development plan process where we're actually developing it ourselves, that parcel was advertised for comment for 30 days, and we evaluate the comment. It's over our spending authority or our receipt authority for that parcel, so we have to go to the Board of Regents for approval. We negotiate that. We work with appraisers to determine fair market values. And does that answer your question?
Excellent answer. How will you go about addressing sensitive parcels like Neach Bay and the watershed for the fish hatchery? If you would walk through that hypothetically for us, what I'm trying to do is to. I've read 100 and some odd emails today, and I feel the energy just around this table, and there's so much concern, you know, about, well, what's the university going to do, and how are they going to change and, mostly negatively affect these communities. And of course, it seems that, you know, Mr. Beadle and yourself are saying that in many ways the university is a good steward of the land and actually is going to go about trying to improve the communities. Can you give us a hypothetical as to how the university would approach, let's say, the Neach Bay area? Is that a good question, Representative Elkins?
Sure. Well, first, if there hasn't been a lease that's been signed with the state of Alaska, we'd want to work with the aquaculture people to get that their rights solidified so they know what their rights are. We then would determine whether or not there's a need to develop that property immediately. It may not be developable for 50 years. We're in perpetuity. So lots of these parcels will sit in our inventory long term. But we would work very closely with the community, with the aquaculture group, be very sensitive to water quality. And there are laws that protect water quality. I can't see an immediate development opportunity for that parcel myself. We're just thinking about that parcel right now. We'd be several years while we evaluate inventory. We have a lot of property in the Mat-Su Borough, for example. That's one of the fastest growing areas of the state. You know, we can only do so many subdivisions a year, and we evaluate our inventory every year and choose five or six parcels to evaluate for development. So we would work closely with the lessee and the community to determine what's the best use of that property. In Ketchikan right now, we've had a property in our inventory for 20 years that the community recreates on. And, you know, while we may want to develop it and generate revenue from it, it's a very popular area. It's got trails on it. We've worked with the Forest Service and the State Parks people to legitimize those trails and upgrade those trails, and the community's working on ways to purchase the parcel and, you know, use it for what they would like to see it used for. So
that's an excellent segue to my next question, which, again, going back to the volume of emails that I received, and many of Representative Ledoux have been from your area as well as other parts of the state. Some people are concerned that they're going to see no trespassing signs go up on university lands once they're titled over. There are people that feel like they do subsistence hunting for deer on those lands. How is the university going to treat those aggregate lands, you know, while they're still inventorying them, while they're still subject to the titles and replats, and you know, you're waiting the appropriate time horizon for that land? What will be the university's posture on those parcels, please?
Well, the bill provides for continued use of these properties by the public. Even if it didn't, we allow the public casual use of university property. We don't police our properties. I can't recall, I'm trying to think of a time we've ever put up a no trespass sign. Representative Gatto could probably speak to the trail system on our campuses in his region. And, you know, we've continue to allow the use of those trails. And actually, there are farm roads, but some people believe they're trails. So we, you know, want the public to be comfortable on our lands. It, you know, we still have to generate revenue from them at some point, probably, but we allow continued use of our properties. If somebody were running a commercial operation off of the property, we would want them to get a permit for that.
Thank you, Mayor. Do we have any questions for Mary from the committee? Representative Gatto?
Just to reinforce what she said, the experimental farm is used by a great many people just to walk. I don't believe you allow motorized vehicles there, and to be honest, I haven't seen any, although I wouldn't doubt for a moment that some
might get through,
stray in there. But very few people use it. But there are no signs warning stay out. There are fences, gates with chains on them, but you just sort of walk around them.
Yeah, and those are to keep the cows in, I believe.
Yeah, and you know why they're there. I mean, there's a trail right there. And you can see that the stock would get out. There's a lot of viewing there. There's the dog trials for the retriever trials. There's a lot of people are using the university land for viewing as well as for some function. And so just to reinforce, they don't seem to take their land away from the public so much as simply own it and look to the future to see what happens to it.
Thank you, Representative Gatto. Anybody else have questions for Mary while she's with us? Terrific. Thank you so much for your help and in debunking the myth that the university is a terrible landlord. We appreciate that. We're going to go back to the phones in Ketchikan. Mike Round, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Mike, we already have your submitted written statement, so if you'd like to use your 3 minutes to read it to us, you're welcome to, but if you'd prefer to just speak off the cuff, we'd appreciate the spontaneity just to keep the committee meeting interesting.
Right. Well, my name is Mike Round. I'm the Assistant General Manager for Southern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association. I didn't have any personal testimony. I was going to read into the record, if you so desire, John Burke's letter that I signed for him. So it beat the desire of the committee or not, whether I read it.
Sure, we'd be happy for you to do that, and we're going to cut you off in about 3 minutes, but feel free to proceed, please.
Okay, it's a one-page letter, so probably should be closed. Dear Representative Ramirez, Representative Samuels, this letter is written to inform you that Southern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association strongly opposes the inclusion of the Neath Creek parcel, which is the Neath Bay Hatchery site and its associated watershed, and those lands proposed to be transferred from the state of to the University of Alaska. We ask you not to transfer this parcel to the University of Alaska, that it remain as state land. The reasons for our opposition to the land transfer are summarized below. One, the Neath Creek land parcel is almost exactly the small watershed that is the sole source of water for the Neath Bay Hatchery and the hatchery site, which lies in the lower end of the parcel at salt water. Two, the Neath Bay Hatchery site is one of the few true production hatchery sites in Alaska that can sustain both large-scale production as well as cost recovery in a special harvest area. Three, the single overriding goal in the administration of the university land is to generate revenue for the university. Four, university land administrators pursue two courses in meeting their goal. If the land is appreciating in value or provides significant revenue through use, it is held. If the land is not appreciating in value or does not otherwise provide funds through use, it is sold to generate revenue. Five, SARA is a nonprofit corporation. Regional commercial salmon fishermen chose to tax themselves 3% of the ex-vessel value of their harvest to initiate funding for SARA in the early 1980s and continue to do so as collateral for Sarah's well-being. If Sarah is significant, six, if Sarah is significantly charged for the use of the Neath Bay parcel, Sarah would necessarily have to increase cost recovery harvest and revenue, taking fish that would have otherwise been harvested by fishermen. This is, in essence, a tax on salmon fishermen. Seven, if Sarah is required to buy the land to retain its current site, the organization will have to increase cost recovery harvest to pay the required loans. Again, this is, in essence, a tax on Southeast salmon fishermen. Eight, if the watershed is used for another form of resource extraction, the quantity and quality of water in the small watershed would likely be altered and detrimental to the hatchery operation. Nine, regardless of whether both parties work in good faith, the current goals of the University Land Administration of the Neath Creek parcel and Sarah are mutually exclusive. 10. The university could not reach its goals without significantly impacting a not-for-profit organization that would have to take more from its users to meet the increased costs of operation. Or, put otherwise, the university would be taxing fishermen to support its program. 11. The other alternative is that Sarah would leave the site and either cease to exist or reduce production to a fraction of what the organization now produces. This would result in a significant loss in harvest for Southeast fishermen. 12. Any long or short-term value of the university would receive for this parcel is very small related to the long-term value now produced for Southeast Alaska communities from Sarah's activity on the site.
Is there a 13?
Nope, that's it.
Nice.
Thank you.
Mike, thank you very much. And again, we have that that written statement submitted and available for the committee. Next, we're going to go to Kenneth Duggett with the Gill Netters Association. Is that right? Would you state your name for the record, please, Kenneth?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. I've been speaking to a muted phone.
It's
My name is Kenneth Duckett. I'm the Executive Director of United Southeast Alaska Gill Netters. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to testify this afternoon, and I appreciate you allowing me to do that. This facility, this hatchery facility, is extremely important to our fleet. It's a large contributor to our fleet. It contributes about 50% of the fish caught in District 1 and 30% in District 106 and 108. I've outlined those considerations and others in a letter that I sent to the committee yesterday. I won't go through that. I just want to comment on a couple of things that that Mr. Beadle said. He talked about the bears at Neath Bay, and that is certainly a byproduct of the hatchery development there. But that's all it is. The focus and function of the hatchery is to provide fish for the common property fishery. And that's why fishermen support it, and that's why it's in existence. The fact that the bears started using the creek is incidental to that activity. The well-being of that hatchery is founded on its water supply, and John Burke's letter made reference to that. I believe, our association believes, and I think the Sarah Board believes, that the development of commercial activity in that watershed is unacceptable, and it cannot be done in such a way as to protect the quality of water that we need for the intense activity and raising of the number of fish that we raise in that hatchery. And to compromise the economic integrity of that hatchery for a short-term sale of property for recreational use or even lodge or commercial use, I think is fundamentally irresponsible and unacceptable, and I just would like to see the hatchery out. Somebody mentioned that they would study the site and determine the best use for the property. It's my firm belief and our firm belief in the association that the best use for that property is to provide clean water for our hatchery. And to activities otherwise would compromise that. The fundamental goal of the hatchery to produce fish for Southeast fishermen, sport fishermen, commercial fishermen, subsistence fishermen, that mission is inconsistent with the mission of the University of Alaska Trust Fund to develop as much money as they can from the lands that they have. I don't have any problem at all with the mission of the trust fund or with them developing funds to continue the mission of the University of Alaska. It's certainly a valid mission, but it should not be done at this spot. It should not be done putting this facility at any risk. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your remarks, Mr. Duggett. We're going to go back to Kodiak. Is Ivar with us with the Kodiak Area Native Association?
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. And I would just like to thank you for this opportunity.
State your name for the record, please, Ivar.
Oh, excuse me. Ivar Malutin. And as long as I'm giving you my age, I might as well give you my, I mean, my name, I'm going to give you my age because it's going to be really instrumental in this. I'm 73 years old. I was born and raised in Kodiak. And the reason I'm here is I'm here trying to protect the native rights. And it's something I've not heard here. And it's something that really has to be a big part of this. The University of Alaska is really, really a viable factor for the state of Alaska, and so are the natives. To give you a little history, the biggest impact that Kodiak has ever had was when the Russians sold Alaska, and then also the next one was when the fishermen are moving to Kodiak from down to the western influence. And then after that, of course, the earthquakes, the tidal wave, and World War II, and we're being choked every time something is happening. And right today, there's still lands out at the Navy base, the Coast Guard base, all over, that used to be our traditional grounds. They are no longer our grounds. And now we're talking about some more grounds that could be taken away from us, maybe. And I'm just listening to all these testimonies, and what has happened now is we're moving into grounds that were never traditional grounds, but they were moved there because we moved out of our traditional grounds. And we're going out to this area that we're talking about for seafood. And the history of Kodiak, there never were animals on Kodiak other than bear and foxes. They were the first two. People of Kodiak are people of the sea. We live off the sea. In fact, we're out there harvesting from the sea right now, yesterday, day before, in the same area. And we really don't want to be see our access cut off to this area in any way, shape, or form. But for that matter, any place in Alaska, every single native tribe would sign a resolution today protecting their rights to their traditional lands and their hunting grounds. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. And, we appreciate your important testimony and appreciate a lot. Next, we'd like to go to Bruce Wallace in Ketchikan. Bruce, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bruce Wallace. I'm a commercial fisherman. I'm also on the SARA board. And I just want to concur with Mr. Duggett's comments. I think he's probably put it in as good a light as we can put it. We've developed the area to the maximum extent practical for the hatchery. We think it is the highest and best use, and it would be very difficult for us to see other uses going in that had compatibility. And I think the committee for its time on it.
Our pleasure. Thank you very much for your concise testimony, Mr. Wallace. We're going to go back to John Martin Jr. Tenneke. Do you have that for us? John Martin Jr. and John Martin Sr. Sounds like a
yes.
Yes, sir. Gentlemen.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. If you just tone her down just a little bit, we hear you too well.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I'll try to tone it down. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before the committee today. My English name is John Martin Jr. My tribal name is Zikwa, and I know it, you probably will never be able to spell it and pronounce it, but I'd like to speak just for a few moments today on who I am. I'm a tribal blood descendant of the Tenneke Tlingit Nation, the Tenneke tribe. My role with the tribe is as an ambassador to nations. Entrusted with this authority, I would like to go on record to say that the Tenneke Tribal Council of Elders vehemently opposes this bill if it involves even one footstep on tribal lands That would be the whole of Tenneke Inlet. Tenneke Inlet is owned by the Tenneke tribe in perpetuity. Our ownership predates your state government and predates the birth of your nation. Our lands are not for negotiation, nor are they for trade. And I would also like to state for the record that our land is not about cash, and it is not covertly disguised as research land or educational land. It's about the survival of our sovereign tribal membership. Our claims are valid, and they're existing, and are owned by the Tenneke tribe in perpetuity. That's your word, and I feel confident using that word. And I know I didn't use my 3 minutes, but I believe I've stated what the tribal council has instructed me to convey to you and your committee and the sponsor of this bill, and I surely do appreciate your time.
We thank you, John. We hear the conviction in your voice, and we appreciate your testimony. Is your father there? Does he want to join us also and speak?
I believe he does.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Mr. Martin Sr. For the record, your name, please.
Yeah, my the name I was born with is Akuhish. The name when I became a clan leader is Kahinuk, and my missionary name is John Martin Sr. I was born in Tenneke in 1935, so that makes me 69 years old. I just want to say that I want to speak on behalf of the executive order land that my son mentions, 7179. The Tenneke tribal land must be withdrawn from all legislation until such time as the recognition process has been accomplished. Tenneke has valuable land in the area, and they have been treated like an orphan child. They were left out of the Clinton Hydro Judgment Funds. They were also left out of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And now you want to take the last link of this heritage. The Tenneke tribe was recognized by President Roosevelt back in 1935. He recognized the fact that this land was allodial title. And by giving the executive order land, it is only way that the federal government also recognized our people that were living on this trust land. My preference is this parcel be given back to the Tenneke Nation while the state is in a given mood. No disrespect intended to the University of Alaska land. And we also have an allotment, a trust land in Patterson Bay. And we also have the cannery site that my grandfather, Andrew Jack, leased to Mr. Tennyson to build a cannery on there. And we have 5 archaeological sites in Tenneke. And one of them is the sacred mountain, the gray mountain called Shabbatah. And I am the chairman that actually developed all of the data that was given into the study by the University of Alaska that was supposedly be given to the Congress. So I want to thank the committee for giving me a few minutes to listen to my concerns regarding land. I also made a statement to Senator Lisa Murkowski that all land exchanges, land issues come to a cease until they deal with our precious land on the Chichikov Island and adjacent water sites the water area on Catoshan, adjacent to Catoshan Bay. We give special recognition that we are not opposing the university and our special recognition to Joe Beadle, who is a dear friend of mine, and I want to thank you for giving me a few minutes of your time. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Mr. Martin Kahinuk, and your son, Sequa. We appreciate you representing the feelings of your community and expressing your tribal responsibility to the Tenneke, and I appreciate it a great deal. It means a lot to me because I'm born in the state of Alaska, all, and I have a great deal of respect for, you know, the Alaska Native community, the people that, you know, owned the land first and still are here with us. Before we end the committee hearing today, I think we still have Lance Nelson on the telephone, the Attorney General, who's available to answer any questions. And I didn't know if anybody on the committee had any brief questions for the Attorney General after the things we've heard in preliminary discussion today. Does anybody have anything for Mr. Nelson from the Attorney General's office? Appears, Mr. Nelson, that you get a free pass today. No questions? Representative Seaton has one for you. Are you with us, Mr. Nelson? Did we lose him?
Okay. That I wasn't sure whether it was appropriate for Bob Loeffler or not. I was just wondering that on some of these parcels we're showing trails that haven't been reserved, and I'm just trying to, at some point, maybe for the next hearing, if we don't have time today, ask about some of those, why some of the trails, such as the one through Neat Bay, that, or Neat Lake, whichever it was, doesn't continue through and give access beyond, which shows as being a trail there now. And I just want to make sure that we're preserving all those accesses so that if the department could let us know on those.
Our pleasure, Representative Seaton. Will you get with Representative Seaton and get straight on that and make a brief presentation to us on Monday when we reconvene for additional public testimony? Does anybody have any concluding remarks they'd like to make, Representative Gatto?
This on page 2 of the fact sheets. Mm-hmm. It does not include any producing oil or gas or mineral properties not legislatively designated state game refuges, critical habitat areas, parks, comma, and then this part, or public use areas. That's a wide open invitation, I think. Your question?
Through the chairman, there is a legislatively designated public use area that was referring to the Nelchina public use area, the Madison Valley Moose Range. Public use areas are specifically designated by the legislature.
Any other questions, Representative Ledoux?
No questions.
Closing remark?
Closing remark. I have with me copies of email sent to our office today concerning HB 130. Some of them are in the packet that you gave to the committee. Some of them are not, and my aides made copies for everybody so that they can be part of the record.
Thank you. So noted. And I would encourage anybody on the committee to see me afterward if you feel like we need to slow the process down or alter it at all. I want to make sure that we give plenty of sunlight to this process so that those folks that feel rushed or in any way feel uncomfortable with how we're proceeding, that they get a good, clean, fair hearing on this. Representative Seaton?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just one other thing, and that is I'd like to get an explanation on Section 6, 1440-366, and seems like there's quite a bit of changes in the repeal and adding back, and I'd like to get some explanation of why we're eliminating the public policy sections of the current 1440-366. And I'll provide you a copy of that.
Okay. Any other closing remarks? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. We're adjourned at 3 o'clock.